All right, let's call the judiciary meeting to order. Let's see, it's 1:37. Senator Dyson is with us, Senator Wilkowski and Chair Coghill. I think I heard that Senator McGuire is going to be here shortly. I don't expect to see Senator Olson here today. For the those listening in, I was talking to the members before. We're going to have a quick update on Senate Bill 108 from Senator Dyson. Since I said we were going to hear it today, I think we'll just give an update. 128, Senator Meyer's electronic bullying, we have that up. We have a CS that we'll adopt and discuss that. My expectation is to amend that and move it. The same thing with Senate Bill 171, which is our multidisciplinary child protection teams. These have been heard. I'm sorry, you want me to take a brief of these? Let me take it in these for a second. The Judiciary Committee back together. We had a little technical difficulty there. The last thing we're going to do in committee is Senate Bill 176, which is the regulation of firearms on the university. And my expectation today is to let the bill be introduced. President Gamble is here today. He wanted to testify, and we'll have a couple other testimonials. Senator Dyson, we were talking last about Senate Bill 108, and I think there's still some issues that we want to talk about. Could you give us a short update real briefly?
Yeah, thank you. I've asked Chuck Kopp, my chief of staff, Nancy Mead from the court system here to explain what's going on. I had hoped that we worked on this all quite a bit of the weekend, and this morning meeting with Health and Human Service on their concern. I was hoping that we'd get something in the Department of Law. Mr. Kopp will explain what we have so far for a committee substitute that we expect will be modified a bit before we lay it before you on Wednesday. Mr. Kopp.
Just as brief as you can be. We started a little bit late, so keep it concise, please, Mr. Kopp.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Dyson. There were 5 points committee asked us to go and look at this last time. One was to look at possible language that would make confidential records of criminal cases before the effective date of the act where charges were acquitted, dismissed, or a combination thereof, so that those people that came on essentially court view electronic case access system at the time would apply to them rather than just going forward. We've done that, and we feel we've covered that now with legislative intent language. Mr. Chair, we've extended the time limit of 90 days from the date of acquittal, dismissal, or combination thereof for a record to become confidential. Law asked us to make that 120 days so it would match the 120-day rule. We've done that, and we've also changed the effective date of the act from July 1st, 2014 to October 1st, 2014 to give the court more time to comply with the request of the legislation. The fourth point that is unresolved is law is asking that all cases be made confidential only if they were dismissed by the prosecuting authority, not for any cases that were dismissed by the court in the furtherance of justice or for other reasons. So I have asked, because that is a point of discussion, Ms. Means hears from the court to talk about what that would mean. And the second point is whether or not we can have a confidential carve-out for state agencies on the database that is otherwise confidential to the public, and she is prepared to address both those points.
Okay. Yeah, just for the record, Senator McGuire's joined us, and Senator, we're on 108, and we're not. It's not an action item. We're just getting an update because we were talking about it Friday, and looks like we're building a CS, and they just wanted to give us an update on what the potential issues were. Nancy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. And also for the record, the court has no position on this bill. We are neutral. But again, I appreciate the sponsor's office working with us to make sure that whatever is decided is something that we can implement. I was asked to address other reasons for dismissal other than dismissals by the prosecution. Mm-hmm. And there are reasons that the court dismisses a criminal case. It is not the case that the court dismisses criminal cases that are just old or stale or something like that. That is not a that doesn't happen in criminal cases except for if there's a violation of the speedy trial rule, and that is something that the parties would know about, and the court doesn't have cases sitting around that after a while it says to the prosecutor, we're going to dismiss these. That might happen in some civil actions, but not criminal actions. But the court does dismiss some criminal actions for reasons that are listed in Rule of Criminal Procedure 43, that is in furtherance of justice, or for mistaken identity. And so there are reasons, or if probable cause is not found under Criminal Rule 5.1, and those are reasons that would be discussed with the prosecutor and that the parties would know about. The court doesn't just dismiss any criminal cases without people knowing about it. And the other point I wanted to make is that when charges are dismissed or cases are dismissed, criminal cases are dismissed, the court itself signs an order making that dismissal official. So it would be somewhat confusing to the issue, I think, if you had cases dismissed by the prosecution treated differently from cases dismissed by the court, because even when the prosecution dismisses them, there's a court order that sort of implements that decision by the prosecutor, and the judge signs off on that. So I just wanted to clarify that point. The other question was whether a state agency, I think in this case it's DHSS, can get access to confidential files that are on court view, and I understand that they want access for public safety reasons or other reasons. We don't currently have a means of doing that. We have the public version of court view that you and everybody can look at from their computer at home, and then we have an internal court version of court view. But we don't have a system whereby anybody can look at the court's internal system of court view to see confidential cases. I'm not saying that it would be impossible, but it would take quite a change to our system to have some sort of password protection access to those cases. And so I haven't figured out whether it's at all doable, but if it were doable, it would not be free. And so I wanted to make that point. And I guess I'd also just add that there are ways that the way prosecutors get access to confidential cases is by being cleared through APSIN to be able to look at then everything that's entered criminally in the state's criminal databases. And when things go on to court view, they go on to APSIN. So that might be an alternative. But I guess I'm still discussing it with the sponsor's office, but sure. Wanted to put that on the
record. And this was just to get an update on what the discussion was, and I didn't intend to bring up a lot of time on the issue, but those are some of the issues that are coming forward, and as the next CS comes up, then it won't be a mystery of how we got where we're at. Thank you, Mr. Cotton. Thank you, Ms. Mead. Hold it, Chuck.
Real quick points. Hung juries and moving violations, how are they treated?
Would that be a question for Mr. Mead, the court, or hung juries, and what was the other question? Moving violations.
I'll give it a shot through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. Moving violations, I think you're talking about traffic minor offenses would not be covered. This is for criminal cases, and those would not be covered by this bill. At least that's my reading of the bill. And hung juries, the person, I might defer to the Department of Law on exactly what the status of those cases were. I mean, they have 120 days to retry. If they retry, it's my understanding that if it's a hung jury, the person is not found guilty, and therefore it would be covered by the bill. But again, I might be incorrect on that.
Okay. All right, thank you. And that really gets to the heart of the question of trying to balance between the right of people to know for public safety reasons and the right of mm-hmm. people to be protected from being given a bad reputation, right? All right, so thank you very much for the update.
real quick.
This is burning into a lot more time than I figured, Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Really quickly through the chair. And Nancy, I know you've been working with our office, but just quickly, what in the bill would we need to change to address the case of, for Nancy Means, her case where she was arrested on a suspicion of intoxication, clearly was not a drinker.
Excuse me.
Okay, go ahead.
Point of order.
Yeah.
I think the chairman is really wanting to get on, and that's
okay.
A discussion
okay.
We'll have on Wednesday.
And the bill actually will come back up
okay,
Wednesday.
Okay, good. Is that going to be in the CS?
I think Nancy's covered yeah. Under what we have, but we'll get into on Wednesday.
And I know you have a bill also up.
Yeah, I was told that she was not, actually, because what I was told, if I might, Mr. Chairman, was that in this case, what your bill does is it allows for those who have been, it's their arrest and charging documents, but only then if they have had a dismissal or an acquittal. In this case, Nancy didn't go on to be charged with anything because she blew a 000. So there wasn't anything that she was charged with. So yeah. She still had an arrest,
and
that's what the concern is.
Sure, we had quite a lengthy discussion yeah. About this at the last committee meeting.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator McGuire, through the chair, we did have this discussion, and the court is addressing that very situation through
okay.
A court rule right now so
okay.
That charges that are not filed by the prosecutor will be addressed, and therefore we didn't pick it up in the bill.
Okay.
And it's within, and we can talk about it later, but it is within the court's authority to address those situations.
Separate from the bill. Okay.
Right.
Thank
yeah,
you
we
very
had
much.
Quite a discussion on that in the
great.
Last committee. So with that, thank you, Mr. Kopp. Thank you, Nancy Mead. And that will bring up Senate Bill 128 by Senator Meyer on electronic bullying, which is Senate Bill 128.
Electronic bullying. This is CS? Okay. Do you want a motion to adopt this?
Yes.
This before we yes, I think. Before we get to the senator, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Senator McGuire to adopt the P version, which is the new CS, and then I'll have you explain it. So, if you wouldn't mind.
I have Y. Yeah.
Is it? So I have Y too. I think is the new one.
Oh, excuse me.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the new CS for Senate Bill number 128/Y for purposes of discussion.
Oh, I'll object because this came floating in as I was making the motion almost. So, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Judiciary Committee. Yes, it has been relatively quick, and I am not able to explain the changes, but my trusty staff can. So with your permission, sir, I'll turn it over to Edra.
Thank you, Edra.
Okay. For the record, Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Meyer. Since the last hearing on this bill, which was February 19th, we've gone through a couple of different iterations on some of the language in here to make it more clear and to ensure that there was no overlapping statutes, that this was going to cause differing penalties for the same sorts of for the same infractions. So the changes to the version Y that you have in front of you sort of rearranges the language to make it more clearer that there are three results that would cause this electronic harassment to become a crime, and those three are causes severe mental or emotional injury, places a person in fear of significant damage to the person's property, or places the person in reasonable fear of physical injury. We have worked with the Department of Law, the Public Defender's Office, and our legal services to come up with this latest version, and we think that it accomplishes some of the issues that were raised at the first meeting.
All right. The four changes that I see then are causes a severe mental emotional injury on line 5. Significant damage instead of just damage, because it looks to me like if it was not significant damage, then it could be any little damage, right? So this, you want to have a higher penalty deal there.
That's
and
great.
Then the reasonable fear is you took both. Well, I see. You took reasonable. That's the standard. All right. And it seemed to me like there was one other place where you. What was one of the other actionable items you put in here? Did I miss anything, or was that all of it?
No. For the record, again, Edra Moorledge, we did add some sort of quantifying language, which was reasonable fear, and then significant damage. So our first version was quite broad, so
okay,
we put in that clarifying language.
Okay. And the significant damage, I see where you added fear of significant damage, and can you explain that?
For the record, Edra Moorledge, yes, that actually was one of our most recent changes. It just happened today. The Department of Law brought it to our attention that there is overlapping property crime statute in another section of the Alaska statutes that they both carry different penalties. This would be a lesser penalty. Therefore, someone charged with a property crime of a certain level could argue that they should be charged with this Class B misdemeanor. So we changed that at the request of the Department of Law earlier.
And that was going to be my next question. This stays within the Class B misdemeanor
yes.
category, true?
Correct.
All right. Is there questions for the Senator Dyson?
Yeah, I'm troubled by the inherent subjectivity of the damage to the victim, and maybe somebody in the courts could help me.
Yeah, well, I have Kathleen Strasbaugh from the Ledge Legal on, who could probably is she online or here in line?
And then okay. I have another question for the. I realize that children and people. Maturity helps people deal with all this kind of stuff, and an age limit is an arbitrary choice, and so on. But did you ever consider in doing this people with developmental disabilities, i.e. handicapped folks, who I would think on some level are particularly vulnerable? Was that ever part of the discussion?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dyson, yes, we did discuss that. We discussed, cyberbullying can and does impact everybody of all ages and of all capabilities and disabilities. Our intent here was to try to stay pretty narrow and focus this on children under 18, because what we've been seeing in the lower 48 anyway is a lot of youth suicides, and they trace that back, and it had to do with a Facebook posting or an email harassment. We think that we may need to pursue this, or I'll let Ms. Moorledge answer it. I brought up the intellectual disabilities for folks over age 18, and they seem to have additional protections that others don't have. And I'm hoping that they will be already protected from this. But let me ask or let somebody else who knows.
But, yeah, thank you.
Edward, did you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dyson, we did talk about that, like the sponsor mentioned, and we felt that it was probably just more of a policy call as to what groups of folks you would want to include in this. But as he said, that was our main intention was just to protect student school-age children because of the occurrence of bullying that already occurs. It's not necessarily electronic, and just sort of add this to the realm of that. However, I think that we would certainly be amenable to adding other groups of vulnerable folks.
Senator Dyson, to continue.
Well, the first thing we should probably do, and maybe I should have done, and that is find out what protections there are against this sort of stuff for people with disabilities, and I suspect it's already addressed somewhere, so we can find out about it later. Thank you.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Through the chair, just a couple questions.
Senator Meyer or your staff, what is the mental intent? It looks to me like on page one, the guiding statute that's already there under 1161.120 says they commit the crime of harassment with the intent to harass or annoy another person. So it's intentional, not reckless. I just want to know how you're interpreting the mental intent.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, that is correct. It would be intentional.
Okay. And I think that's important because when we think about young people, and, you know, we certainly know of the case that you're talking about, those are horrible cases, and we don't want to see those. But we also know that kids, you know, expressing their First Amendment rights often do things that they don't recognize the consequences of, and they may be acting in a reckless manner. And certainly we need to be cautious of that, too. Then my next question is on the standard on page 2, 4 through 6, then, when we're looking then at the person who's receiving that electronic communication, not the one sending it, would the standard then be a reasonable person similarly situated? So that we're looking at what does it mean to be insulted, taunted, challenged, or intimidated? Is it someone that age, similarly situated? How would they feel then, that test?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire. That is our intent. I'm not exactly sure how in reality that is determined in a court. So maybe perhaps.
And maybe Annie can come up. Annie, if you're following these questions that I'm asking. Just so that we get it on the record that the intent, it would be, the mental intent is intentional, not reckless, and that the standard then that by which the victim is judging is a reasonable, you know, reasonable person similarly situated of the same age in the same circumstances so that we don't end up with, you know, odd results of someone who's, you know, particularly sensitive or those kinds of things. And then the final question I have for you with the new addition on line 10 is, what does significant damage mean? How do we define significant damage? And then also person's property. How far are we going to go in that? Is that the cell phone? You know, is that a shirt? Is it? What do we mean when we say that? Because that's a broad thing. Is it their locker? What is it?
Correct. Through the chair, Senator McGuire. In our first draft of the bill, we had simply damage to the person's property, and after working with the Department of Law, Legal Services, and the Office of the Public Defender, it was sort of, it was agreeable between all of us that placing significant in there would raise the bar high enough, and again, I'm not exactly sure how that would be applied in reality, and again, if maybe we can have the court speak to that.
Okay.
Probably clarify
I think
that.
That's important, mm-hmm. through the chair. To have that on the record, again, because if it's a subjective standard, you know, you're talking about, you know, crime of harassment in the second degree. I don't know what the penalties are for that. I'd like that on the record, too, but that's a significant deal. So we need to know what is that amount, and also then a little bit about what somebody believes, I guess, the person's property is. But, okay. Thanks.
Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I do think a lot of the questions you're asking will be best be handled by Annie Carpinanti, but a lot of these issues, whether it be school bullying, I mean, I think that was actually your bill, Senator McGuire, you know, where school districts already have anti-bullying policy in place, and then we also already have harassment bills in place. And all we're trying to do now is to include all the social media that kids thrive on, as you know. And so that's all we're trying to do with the cyber part of this, not trying to recreate the whole
Absolutely.
Harassment and bullying.
And I agree with it, if I might, through the chair, Senator Meyer. I completely agree. I just want to be sure, because with electronic communication, there's a little bit more room there for it to be, you know, even accidentally sending or sending things, you know, forwarding some kind of a thing that you get on Facebook that somebody else sent, and not to say that doesn't hurt somebody's feelings, but I just want to be sure that we've got it in that squarely in that realm of you're intentionally hurting someone, and I think we do know what that means, but
right. Senator Wilkowski, you had questions.
Yeah, thank you, and I have some specific legal questions along the same lines as Senator McGuire, but just on a policy perspective, is there we're limiting this to electronic communications, and is there really a difference if I look, you know, get 6 inches from your face and start screaming, taunting you, insulting you, challenging you, or if I write it down on a piece of paper and then give it to you, or even if I tell you on the telephone? Is there really a difference there? Because we're limiting those. If you do that, in other words, if I write something down and I give it to you, or if I tell you to your face, it could be horrendous, cause you severe mental emotional injury, but we're not criminalizing it. But if I send an email to you, we are criminalizing it. And I just, for the record, a little bit of maybe the policy call on that.
Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wolakowski, I think, you know, and I'm not an expert on social media, but, you know, like Facebook, MySpace, Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, blogs, you know, when you can post derogatory statements or photos like that on these social medias that can potentially be seen around the world, to me that's much more detrimental than if you just tell me to my face in our privacy that...
Senator Meyer, on page one... the sub one would, if you provoke them in a way that would bring an immediate violent response, that could be probably, it could be written, I suppose. It could be verbal. And then just to the answer, I think what the senator is bringing up, subjects another person to offensive physical contact. Would that be it, Senator Wolakowski?
Well, if I were the we're creating two different standards, and I'm just I'm just free thinking here, because I think it's an important discussion to have anytime you know, tinkering with this First Amendment in particular. But if I were to insult you in a way that provoked an immediate violent response, then yeah, that would be covered under 1161.120(a)(1). But if I just caused you emotional injury, then there wouldn't. I've done nothing wrong. Whereas if I do the same thing in an email to you, then it is a crime. So I'm just thinking aloud on the policy implications there. And then the sending an electronic communication, that was another question I had for law. Maybe you can answer it. Does sending an electronic communication apply, would Facebook, does that apply to Facebook or Twitter, or does it have to be directly to the person? In other words, if I post a Facebook post, is that considered sending an electronic communication? It's probably a legal question.
Senator Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, I think we do have the answer, but I'll let Ed.
Edra?
Yes, Edra Moreledge, staff to Senator Meyer. I spoke extensively with our legal services and our drafter, Ms. Kathleen Strasbaugh, who's on the line to answer questions, and she was in agreement that the posting to or sending an electronic post to a Facebook or a blog would be considered sending something. It would not necessarily need to be sent directly to that person. And I think that she was prepared to speak to that specifically today.
Kathleen, are you online with us?
I am online, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Senator Wolakowski, I think that send, provided isn't send to a person, is sufficient to cover posting on a social media site where others might see it.
Senator Wolakowski has another question. Kathleen.
So on that point, if sending an electronic communication, if I am not Facebook friends with the person, but I go on my Facebook page and I insult them, intimidate them, but I'm not friends with them, would I be violating the law?
It really depends on how public your site is or whether it's designed in a manner that the other person can find out about it. I think I can certainly see some interesting issues for a prosecution, but you belong to a small group of high schoolers, you know, and you post it on your Facebook page, and all the person's friends will tell them. I mean, I think you'd have a problem, and if you posted it for, you know, about someone that's not likely to read it, that's something else again.
Senator Wolakowski,
if I post something and then how about I send something, an email to my friend, and then my friend forwards the email on to someone under 18, and they're insulted by my email that I sent to my friend. Would that meet
the standard? Well, it's going to depend, as discussed, on the intention of the sending party. If there are problems with pursuing these in prosecution, I'm sure the Department of Law will point them out to us.
And Senator Wilkowski.
Since we have law on the phone, Mr. Chair, just on the issue of treating electronic communications differently than face-to-face communications, letters, handwritten letters, do you see any equal protection issues or any other issues by doing that?
Mr. Chairman, is that addressed to me?
Yes.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, it strikes me that the communications are all of a certain type, insulting and provocative, in a manner extreme enough to be criminalized. This is a Class B misdemeanor with a maximum penalty of 90 days, and I don't know the fine off the top of my head. And we have a number of different offenses within this under the statute at that same penalty level that have similar components. Direct contact, anonymous obscene phone calls, and so on. It strikes me that the legislature can make a policy determination that they are equivalent for the purpose of the statute.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. It seems to me that the Supreme Court over the years has allowed some pretty heinous communications to be considered free speech. Do you have any concern that the court might find that this oversteps the First Amendment?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, if the intent is to harass or annoy, that would probably depend on who the person is and what the circumstances are. The court seems to make its decision on whether one of our offenses involving communication or conduct that is not physically injurious on a case-by-case basis, depending on what exactly happened and who the parties are that are involved. So it would be very difficult to speculate. I think it's probably going to be a situation where the court will decide if the statute is applied incorrectly rather than whether it's a violation of the First Amendment on its face.
Senator Wilkowski.
Do you, if someone sent out an email talking about what a terrible football player somebody was, and how would the court evaluate that? Let's say someone was very fragile and they caused emotional injury. How would the court look at that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I don't know. It's an intentional crime, not one of negligence. So it's hard to, but it would depend on the circumstances. I really can't imagine that it would, that we could make some kind of blanket statement about the circumstances under which this might not be easy to prosecute, or in cases where it might be relatively easy to prosecute.
And then,
And I was also going to ask Annie Carpinetti to come up, but go ahead. One more question, Senator Wilkowski.
So on the causes fear of significant damage to the person's property, this discussion came up last week, and I appreciate the efforts to fix it, but
there is a mistake.
The example that came up was a pencil. If someone, if I say, I'm going to break your pencil, and breaking your pencil would cause significant damage to that pencil. So would that, I think I know where you're trying to go, or would the sponsor's trying to go with that, but would that be considered a crime under this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilkowski, but actually first, Mr. Chairman, there's a duplication in the, do you have the Y version before you?
Yes, ma'am.
Chairman? Okay. There's a duplication that I wanted to point out to everyone. starting on page 7, causes fear of significant damage to the person's property, can all be stricken, because you'll see that significant damage to the person's property is contained in Romanet 2.
Right.
But at any rate, I would have to defer to the sponsor as to what the intentions were with respect to the property.
Okay, since I've objected to holding this this CS, maybe we just lay it aside and pick that back up. But I think on some of the questions, it would be good to have Annie Carpinetti come up, if you don't mind. There's probably the equal protection issue for similarly situated, and then some of the levels of how you would apply this. So, Annie, thanks for coming to the committee, and thanks for being willing to testify on this. Did you catch some of the questions, or do you want me to have them ask you more specifically?
I think I caught some of them, but if you could ask them. First of all, my name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division. I would point out that that under 18 years of age is not brought down to fear of physical injury and significant damage to a person's property. The way it's the Y version is drafted now, it's under 18 years of age only for for conduct that causes severe mental or emotional injury, and that I don't know whether that's a mistake or not. Maybe it's intentional, but it hasn't been mentioned.
Okay.
And with that, I wanted to thank the sponsor, because we did bring before him the concern about fear of danger, damage to property. It's hard to imagine how an electronic communication might cause damage to property. I'm trying to use my imagination. Maybe somebody puts out on an email, "Oh, let's meet over at somebody else's house and set fire to the doghouse or something," but our concern was that it overlapped with criminal mischief, and our criminal mischief statutes define damage to property in a really logical way. It's like theft. It's you cause $25,000 or more damage to property, it's a certain level crime, and it goes all the way down to, I think, under $50, just like our theft statutes. So that's something I think ought to be considered, whether we want it to include fear of significant damage, which under this bill is a Class B misdemeanor, and it might be, if it's significant, not to a pencil, but, you know, monetary-wise, they're set out in terms of monetary damage to property. So anyway, and now I'll give it a shot to answer all the questions.
All right, thank you. Senator McGuire and then Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, through the chair. So, Ms. Carpinetti, so my question is, I like the bill. I like the concept. Senator Meyer always brings good bills. But under Section 1, Sub A, is that not good enough language to charge somebody as it stands right now? And I guess I just wonder, in creating the separate subsection, or would there be another way to do it that simply clarifies that in doing that because the standard is that if the crime of harassment in the second degree is that with the intent to harass or annoy the person, they insult, taunt, or challenge another person in a manner likely to provoke an immediate violent response. Mm-hmm. Period. So that's what we do. Now, if there's some confusion about whether you can do that by sending an electronic communication, is there a way to just clarify it within what we already have? It feels messy, and it looks disjointed, and I worry that we're creating a separate standard. I mean, now instead of the notion of in a manner likely to provoke an immediate violent response, we're actually saying that we're saying that you actually have to cause severe mental or emotional injury. So really, we're making it harder for the person who's receiving electronic communication. I mean, that is a fact. And I don't know that we want to do that, because I think if it's harassment, it's harassment. And I think that we all understand what that is. And if you're insulting, taunting, challenging a person in a manner likely to provoke an immediate violent response, there's all kinds of ways that you're going to do it. And as technology improves and changes and things like that, you might be doing it from a spaceship. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But to continue to add 7s, 8s, 9s, 10s, 11s, and then different methods by which that type of harassment is carried out in a second degree sort of clutters our statutes. I'm just saying, I think Senator Meyer has a good idea. It's representing, 2014, but I don't really like the way it's doing it. And I'm wondering if you could help kind of just put that notion in here if it's not clear.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, I'd be happy to help. And I think you've got an interesting approach to this. This is very difficult writing.
I know.
It's really hard, but I would certainly be happy to try and help. The difference in A1 for harassment is that it's immediate violent response. And the proposal is an electronic communication, which does not require that immediacy of a response. And that's the difference. But, it certainly is something that I would really be happy to work on.
I had two other, Senator Wilkowski and Senator Dyson. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. President. Or Mr. Chair.
So, does roll off the tongue.
You heard some of my questions before, and I'll just ask them again. Maybe you can give your take on it. So, the sending electronic communication, if you would agree or disagree with what was said about whether that applies to a Facebook post, the significant damage is that, you could significantly damage someone's pencil when you break it. Or is it sort of like a monetary amount, like over $500 or something like that? And then the policy, whether you think there's equal protection or any other constitutional issues with treating electronic communications differently than phone, letter, in-person communications.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I'll take the easy one first. Sends, an electronic communication. If it were me drafting it, I would probably say sends or posts. Just to be clear, I'm not saying that that this is a mistake. It's just that since it's been raised, I would probably, just as a drafting matter, I would probably say something like sends or post. Not that anybody is mistaken with this, but the second, that's the problem with significant damage to a person's property. It doesn't, it technically covers breaking somebody's pencil because that's significant damage to property, which is why our criminal mischief statutes break it down into the value of the damage, how much damage is caused. And that's a lot easier to understand and to enforce, I think, than significant damage. And the third, equal protection, I guess I'd like to think about it. Electronic communication, there is reason to justify this that Senator Meyer mentioned, is that an electronic communication gets sent to a lot of people, and the potential for publication over a wide variety of people, I think, is a lot more higher than words verbally or letters or papers. So I would say there is that difference, but I wouldn't like to say it doesn't violate equal protection. It certainly would be raised, I would imagine.
Senator Wilkowski, and then I want to get to Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The intent. So emails get forwarded on all the time. If I, sometimes you get emails with a couple hundred people, copied on it. If I respond back and one of those happens to be someone under 18 and I happen to say something that causes them severe mental injury, have I violated the law if I didn't intend to violate? I mean, is it person specific? Do I have to know the victim, or can it just be I was really stupid and said something that I shouldn't have? And you see what I'm saying?
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I think the culpable mental state is intending to harass or annoy the victim, not the person that you were talking about. That's how I would read it.
So in that particular case, no crime's been committed?
Not under this that I can tell.
No. Senator Dyson, you had a question?
Yeah, thank you. I could see how property could be damaged for an adult. You could send out a message that says, every product your business produces stinks, or the piece of property you're trying to sell has got the federal pollution site or something, you know. But my, when I was charmed, I thought an earlier version said that it was a penalty for annoying people, and I was charmed by that one. But
well, this does. It says with intent to harass or annoy another person, you make.
I can think of a lot of applications. But
oh, me too.
But back to my earlier question, could you briefly say something about what protections are already in the law for handicapped, disabled people?
Especially not.
Yes.
Whoa. I think we have people from DHSS, which might,
and
might know.
I think probably what I'm going to do is I'm going to leave that question hanging because I think we had the sponsor should get the right person to not only research but bring that back to us. And I'm going to ask Senator McGuire to withdraw her motion to adopt the Y version because it's already been noted at least one mistake, and certainly there are other issues in this particular legislation. I've already had to kick one bill off the schedule because of this. I thought we might have had a little different discussion around this, but so would you just withdraw the motion to adopt?
Withdraw respectfully and work with.
Yeah. And I think there's some work to do on this, obviously. Senator Wilkoski, you had a question.
You know, there's a really good, I'm just looking online, Vanderbilt Law Review article on constitutionality of cyberbullying laws, and it goes through, talks about what other states are doing. I think I agree with the concept of what we're trying to do. I think the way it's written, there are probably some pretty severe First Amendment issues. But I think we can come up with something, and I would suggest that Law Review article as a starting point. I'm sure there are many others, Mr. Chair.
I think that's an excellent suggestion. I think we've ran ourselves into a place where we got to rethink a couple of things in this. Senator, if you wouldn't mind, maybe from the Law Review, some of the questions that come up from the committee members. This particular draft, that leaves us with the original bill that we adopted originally, and come back to us with some changes. I am going to have trouble keeping a committee going this week, but I think we can get there. You've heard the Senator to my right's discussion, so if you don't mind. So I'm going to lay Bill 128 aside as we still continue our arduous work of trying to find that balance. I'm going to push 171 off to another day, which is the multidisciplinary child protection teams. My apologies to those who came to testify on that one, but we have the two bills that I thought we were going to be able to deal with in some short order, Senate Bill 108 and 128, have taken that first hour of time. And I do have the Senate Bill 176 up for discussion. Let's go ahead and get the intern that is taking this bill. He will bring it before us, and we have the president of the university is in town today, and I know that he wanted to testify, and I didn't want to lose that opportunity, if you don't mind, members of the committee, that we let him go ahead and introduce it. And I wanted to give the president ample time to give his testimony, but I also wanted to give ample time for my intern working in my office to present the concept and give his rationale and some backup material. And so let's go ahead and get that on for discussion at this point. So why don't you put yourself on the record, Hans, and introduce this bill.
Okay, for the good afternoon, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Hans Rodvik, intern for Senator Coghill. Thank you for this opportunity to present Senate Bill 176 to you today. Before we dive into what the bill actually does, I'll provide a little context to this issue so that you and members of the public have a proper understanding of how this bill came to be.
Cool.
I attend the University of Alaska Anchorage, majoring in political science. During the fall 2013 semester, a diverse array of students, including myself, from the College Republicans, Young Americans for Liberty, and Political Science Association, came together to analyze what issues these three clubs could join together on and help change. Being mostly political science majors, we all had quite the intimate relationship with the Constitution. Furthermore, as Alaskans, we understood the long and storied firearm culture our state has and the special protections our state constitution guarantees us, specifically concerning the right to keep and bear arms. We concluded that the current situation surrounding firearms on campus was unacceptable and committed to change it. Senate Bill 176 was generated by grassroots efforts by concerned students who understand individual liberty, the U.S. and Alaska constitutions, Alaska statute, and the rule of law. I presented the idea of Senate Bill 176 to Senator Coghill upon being accepted into the internship program, and he agreed, and from there, well, as they say, the rest is history. With the rest of my time here, I'll describe what Senate Bill 176 does, why this committee should support it, and conclude by giving you a forewarning of some of the coming arguments. What does Senate Bill 176 do? Most importantly, the bill requires the University of Alaska Board of Regents to comply with the Alaska Constitution and Alaska statute. Senate Bill 176 resolves the conflict posed to law-abiding citizens by the UA Board of Regents' policies and regulations. Since 1995, the Board of Regents has, via administrative policy, prohibited the otherwise lawful carrying of concealed handguns. The prohibited areas include university property, university offices or classrooms inside buildings not on university property, and university-sponsored activities or meetings not on university property. The Board of Regents policy makes an unsubstantiated claim to have governing power over possession of firearms. University regulation further compounds the problem by prohibiting firearms from being carried or stored on university property or in university buildings. University regulation, which is different from the policy, disarms students living in dorms by forcing them to hand over their firearms to a university employee, who then stores their firearms in a central safe. The abuses of constitutional rights do not end there. Students who have firearms living in residential units must register their firearms with the university and provide detailed personal information about themselves to a designated university employee. At UAF, the police department requires students to fill out an entire form describing the type of firearm. This includes providing the serial number to the university police department. I see this as a violation of multiple constitutional rights, specifically Article 1, Section 19, Article 1, Section 22, which concerns the right to privacy, and Article 1, Section 14, the right to be secure in an individual's property against unreasonable searches and seizures. University regulation also prohibits firearms in residential rooms or apartments and in any common areas. Lastly, the regulation prohibits firearms on residential grounds. So that essentially covers any and all property of the university. So back to what the bill actually does. In Section 2A of the bill, the legislature reserves the authority to regulate firearms and knives to the state. Unless the legislature specifically designates, the Board of Regents may not enforce a policy regulating the possession, ownership, use, carrying, registration, storage, or transportation of firearms or knives. With this section, the current Board of Regents policy would not be in compliance with statute, and therefore it would need to be eliminated. Section 2B does three things. It requires any policy regulating firearms and knives adopted and enforced by the Board to be identical to state law. This is the most important part of the bill. Secondly, these policies cannot deny or infringe the individual right to keep and bear arms in defense of self or others. Lastly, this section allows the board to have policies that prohibit firearms in restricted access areas of buildings. Two key things to note about the restricted access subsection is that I spoke with the police chiefs at UAA and UAF, and both confirmed that currently there are no restricted access areas on campus, where people are screened or patted down, things along those lines. Also, we carefully defined what a restricted access area is. It's a place where an individual would be screened, which I envision requiring a police officer, a guard, or some form of a security personnel, and these do not include common areas open to the public, which, from my understanding, after speaking with the police chiefs, is all areas of the university. We are not giving the Board of Regents the authority to declare the entire university system a restricted access area. In summary, Senate Bill 176 requires the Board of Regents to come into compliance with our state constitution and state law concerning the regulation of firearms and knives. Senate Bill 176 codifies UA Board of Regents' policy with current statute that already allows law-abiding citizens to carry concealed firearms on campuses. The intent of Senate Bill 176 is to enable law-abiding citizens to exercise their fundamental right to keep and bear arms on and in the grounds of UA campuses. Now, there's four reasons why this committee should support Senate Bill 176, and given the time constraints today, I'll have to move along there. But most importantly, on the constitutional grounds that I already spoke on, our state constitution guarantees that the individual right to keep and bear arms shall not be denied or infringed by the state or a political subdivision of the state. Article 7, Section 3 of the Constitution of the State of Alaska created the Board of Regents. The regents are appointed by the governor and subject to a confirmation vote of the legislature in joint session. Therefore, the University of Alaska and the Board of Regents are political subdivisions of the state. Furthermore, the Board of Regents is bound by the Constitution to formulate policy in accordance with state law. There's no provision granting the Board of Regents authority to dismiss, ignore, or override other parts of the Constitution. It's no question that the Board is a government entity. It is a creation of government. Its employees and managers are paid by the government. Its structures and activities are determined and governed by state law, state constitution, and the UA system only exists as authorized by law. Moving on to the next reason why the committee should support Senate Bill 176, the statutory basis. There's no current statute that prohibits law-abiding adults over 21 and older from carrying concealed on or in our public universities. I'll say that again. It is not a state crime nor a federal crime to carry on or in the University of Alaska system. What's occurring is the administrative policy by the Board of Regents has prohibited this. Furthermore, under Alaska Statute AS.11.61.190 through 11.69.220, state there is no crime to carry on the grounds of UA campuses. Also, under AS.29.35.145, the State of Alaska reserves the right to regulate firearms and knives. Therefore, the university has no authority to continue their current practices. The next point why the committee should consider Senate Bill 176 is the court rulings and historical understanding of the Second Amendment. Two recent court cases deal specifically with this issue of firearms on public campuses. And the Colorado Supreme Court ruled that the Colorado legislature, through their 2011 Concealed Carry Act, divested the Board of Regents of its authority to regulate concealed handgun possession on campuses. The court ruled that had the legislature intended to exclude universities, it would know how to do so, which they did not. In Oregon, the State Court of Appeals ruled that the governing body of the Oregon University System, under their policy prohibiting individuals with concealed weapon permits from carrying concealed campus, was a violation of statute and went against the direct intent of the legislature. There's some other major court rulings supporting the intent of Senate Bill 176. What the Board of Regents is doing by prohibiting the storage of firearms, specifically handguns, in residential units is similar to what the District of Columbia used to do. In the District of Columbia versus Heller, the U.S. Supreme Court found that the district's outright ban on handgun possession in the home amounts to a ban of an entire class of arms that Americans overwhelmingly choose for the lawful purpose of self-defense. The court found that this violated the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. In McDonald versus Chicago, the U.S. Supreme Court found that the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms applies to the states because of the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. The court also reaffirmed Heller by acknowledging that self-defense is a basic right, recognized by many legal systems from ancient times to the present. And the Heller court held that individual self-defense is the central component of the Second Amendment right. The most recent court case, Peruta versus County of San Diego, I believe it occurred within the last couple months, supports the intent of Senate Bill 176. The case was heard in the U.S. 9th District Court of Appeals and found that a responsible law-abiding citizen has a right under the Second Amendment to carry a firearm in public for self-defense. The Second Amendment, Heller tells us, secures the right to protect oneself against both public and private violence, thus extending the right in some form to wherever a person could become exposed to public or private violence. Also within Peruta, the court found that the Second Amendment does not forbid the prohibition of the carrying of arms abroad by a single individual, attended with circumstances giving just reason to fear that he proposes to make an unlawful use of them. The significant rulings acknowledge that the Second Amendment guarantees the individual natural right to self-defense through the keeping and bearing arms. Historical analysis and understanding of the Second Amendment further recognize that bearing arms for the purpose of self-defense is a right not confined to the home. As noted in Heller, the Second Amendment codifies a pre-existing right, the natural right of man, that is, self-provision, self-preservation, and self-defense in his life of property. Given time constraints, like I said, I'll briefly go over some historical understandings of the Second Amendment. These are just quotes from a couple of founders and then older court cases. Our greatest president, George Washington, said in his personal letters that firearms stand next in importance to the Constitution itself. They are the American people's liberty teeth and keystone under independence. From the hour the pilgrims landed to the present day, events, occurrences, and tendencies prove that to ensure peace, security, and happiness, the rifle and pistol are equally indispensable. The very atmosphere of firearms everywhere restrains evil interference. They deserve a place of honor with all that is good. In Wilson versus State of Arkansas, an 1878 court case, the Federal Appeals Court ruled that to prohibit a citizen from wearing or carrying a war arm is an unwarranted restriction upon the constitutional right to keep and bear arms. If cowardly and dishonorable men sometimes shoot unarmed men with pistols or guns, the evil must be prevented by the penitentiary and gallows, and not by a general deprivation of constitutional privilege. In Cochran versus State of Texas, 1859, the court ruled that the right of a citizen to bear arms in lawful defense of himself or the state is absolute. He does not derive it from the state government. It is one of the highest powers delegated directly to the citizen and is expected out of the general powers of government. A law cannot be passed to infringe upon or impair it because the Constitution is above the law and independent of lawmaking power. Given these court cases and historical analysis, the Second Amendment recognizes the individual's right to self-defense. Now for some facts and statistics concerning firearm use and concealed carry. For clarity, these are all on basis and available to the public. They're in the big zip folder. There are now 41 right-to-carry states, 38 of which are shall issue, meaning that an applicant takes a test and passes standards and then receives a permit without discretionary judgment by cops or authorities. Since 1991, when the nation's violent crime rate peaked, 24 states have adopted shall carry laws. Meanwhile, gun laws have become more liberal on the federal and state level, and private ownership of firearms has risen by about 100 million firearms. Subsequently, as of 2010, the murder rate has decreased 52% to a 47-year low, and the total violent crime rate has decreased 48% to a 37-year low. Allowing citizens to carry concealed weapons deters crime. Studying every county in the U.S., economists John Lott and David Muster concluded that violent crime is deterred because of right to carry. When concealed handgun laws went into effect, in a county, murder rates fell by 8.5%, rape rates fell by 5%, and aggravated assaults fell by 8%. In the 1990s, criminologist Gary Kleck found that guns were used for self-protection in America somewhere between 2.1 and 2.5 million times annually. A study for the Department of Justice found that 34% of felons had been scared off, shot, wounded, or captured by an armed citizen. The study also found that 40% didn't commit crimes because they feared victims were armed. Evidence does not exist showing gun control laws reduce crime. In using Kleck's numbers, in those 2.5 million times a gun is used by law-abiding citizens for self-defense. Less than 8% of the time, the citizen kills or wounds his attacker. The criminal is essentially scared off or deterred from committing that crime. It is important for important to note for Alaska, given our nation-leading rape and sexual abuse rates, that as many as 200,000 women use a gun every year to defend themselves against sexual abuse. Nationwide, there are over 500,000 self-defenses used away from the home. These would be attributed to concealed carry. In about 75% of defensive firearm instances, a shot is simply never fired, and the threat is evaded via a defensive display or warning. Economist John Lott also found that in states adopting shell-issue carry laws, the incidence of mass murder drops on the order of 80%. Nearly every shootout between two armed individuals is over in roughly 10 seconds, and while mass shootings can exceed 30 minutes. I'd like to point out the huge success in Florida concerning right to carry and crime rates. Since the mid-1980s, they've issued nearly 2 million permits while revoking only 168 of them due to gun crime by permit holders. This shows that concealed weapon permit holders are very law-abiding citizens. I could continue rattling off the facts all day, but I'd just like to turn now to pointing out some of the inconsistencies of the arguments that you're likely to going to hear. Guns on campus will lead to more crime. This is simply not the case, for we have real examples. Since 06, state law has allowed licensed individuals to carry concealed handguns on the campuses of Utah's public universities. This has also been the case at Colorado State University and a community college in Virginia. Over 100 semesters have passed and not a single instance of gun violence, including threats and suicides, an instance of a person brandishing or alluding a firearm or a threat has occurred on these campuses. You might also hear that guns on campus will distract from the learning environment. The essence of concealed carry is to be discreet and avoid attention. Furthermore, concealed carry, which is normally done by around 1% of a state's population, has not distracted people or increased crime throughout the rest of Alaska. Take, for example, where people are allowed to carry in movie theaters, shopping malls, and restaurants. We don't see an epidemic of crime occurring there because of concealed carry. Colleges are also no more crowded than the movie theaters, office buildings, shopping malls, and numerous other locations where concealed carry is legally already occurring. The committee might also hear that because dorms experience fair amounts of theft, the university has an obligation to ban firearms. This is not a very strong argument, as a prior restraint on our rights. Take, for example, the ban on a person yelling fire in a theater. The legislature and state governments don't go around gagging people within these theaters. The University of Alaska should not ban firearms simply because they believe that there is a possibility for an individual to violate a right. Furthermore, the majority of students living on dorms or in residential units are not even of the legal age to possess a concealed firearm.
And Hans, I'm going to ask you, the good thing is you have done your homework. And by the way, this is the first time he's presented a bill in committee. So what I'm going to do is I wanted to give the president plenty of opportunity to testify. I do have Brian Judy from NRA online, but I'm probably not going to get to him today. I gave you 20 minutes to line it out. I think there's going to be plenty of time for discussion on this. So if you don't mind, if you have anything that you could wrap up with, and I'd like to get to the president.
Okay, so in conclusion, Senate Bill 176 requires the Board of Regents to comply with the state constitution and state law. Senate Bill 176 recognizes that the individual right to keep and bear arms for self-defense and the defense of others should not be denied or infringed by a political subdivision of the state, which the University of Alaska and the Board of Regents are. Senate Bill 176 is supported by our state constitution, court cases, state law, historical analysis of the Second Amendment, and factual evidence and data on firearms and crime. I'd ask the committee to remember that the United States and Alaska is ruled by law and not on emotions. Senate Bill 176 restores the rule of law to Alaska. That concludes my testimony.
Hans, thank you very much. Very thorough. And be careful about making closing comments or closing arguments until we close. But thank you very much. What I'm going to do is, so that I can get President Campbell up, I'm going to reserve questions until the next time we have this bill up. And Mr. Judy, you're online. I'm going to give probably the remainder of the time to President Campbell. And President, if you'll come up, Brian, we'll have plenty of time. This is not going to be a two-hearing bill. This is probably going to take some time. But the President's with us in Juneau today, and I wanted to give him ample opportunity to have this discussion. Welcome to our committee, Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pat Gamble.
Pat, you would move that over. Thank you. Appreciate that.
For the record, my name is Pat Gamble, and I'm the president of the University of Alaska system. I guess I better start off today by saying, first of all, I'm not a lawyer, and so when we get into some of the legalities, then I drop off the line. Pointing some of these out may be part of my role. Debating and arguing them on one side or another probably isn't an area that I'm going to go to. What I want to do today is not talk about the Second Amendment, per se. I mean, I took an oath to defend the Second Amendment, took an oath to do that, been carrying a gun by myself since I was 9 years old, carried two guns in Vietnam every day, an AR-15 and a 38, which I used on several occasions. I shot expert in pistol and rifle and continued to shoot all through my time in the Air Force that way, nevertheless. Had a custom grip Beretta 38 that I carried as a general officer, shot it regularly, went through a number of training courses, both indoors and outdoors. So I'm pretty familiar with weapons. As an installation commander in the Air Force, I was also responsible for the protection of an installation and the idea of how do you protect an installation, which comes into play in this discussion. And so I've got a fairly decent background in which to engage in this conversation. Calling myself an expert, I'm probably far from an expert in the constitutionality issue, but on the practical side of things, I can probably hold my own in the discussion. The issue as I see it is not to take on the Second Amendment. I think that was quite adequately covered with the previous speaker. As he would know, you know, there's two categories of people in this issue, the collective rights folks who have looked at the Second Amendment and then those exceptions that have been provided since that time as a result of population growth and all the things that culture has developed. And then there's the standard model, as we call it, and those are the folks who just say Second Amendment and Second Amendment only. It is in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and that's what's important. And I doubt very seriously if any group of people on either side are going to be persuaded one way or the other with anything I have to say today to shift their positions. So I'm not going to go there. A lot of people have been there before me. In Virginia in 1640, it was required that able-bodied men carry a gun. Noah Webster, George Mason, James Monroe, basic human rights, Sid Monroe, Patrick Henry, James Madison, an author of the Bill of Rights and the Second Amendment, basically placed it in the same part as freedom of religion and freedom of the press. So he clearly intended for it to be an individual right. And so I understand all those things. That's really not where we are today. What we want to do today is look at the language in this legislation, look at the state law, look at how these two come together, and what effect it has on the university as an educational institution. And that's what I plan to do today. So first of all, let me, you heard other states. Other states are all over the map on this. I mean, you can look at probably three or four different categories or more of how states have treated this. So I'm not interested in looking at another state and saying we should do like they did, because their rationale and their reasons may be completely different and their laws may be completely different at the state level. And I didn't go there, so I don't really have an ability to go dissect that any more than to say, as far as I did go, the numbers of states that did one thing or another, or the number of states that are changing their minds, they're all over the map. So again, I think we really, I hope that your intention here is to really focus on what's the right thing for Alaska and our laws as they currently exist. Our laws as they currently exist are a combination of federal law and state law. The bottom line in both cases is that you can possess a handgun at 18 years of age. If you have your parents' permission, you can possess a rifle or a shotgun at 16 years of age. And then you can conceal carry at 21 years of age. It's interesting to note that the bill as it's currently written is not about concealed carry. So concealed carry is not the issue. It's the carrying of weapons. So if we put that in context, that 16-year-old with permission from the parents who has enough money to buy that Bushmaster legally apparently can carry that around. And so those are the kinds of things our state law would allow. So we're an educational institution. Our concern is for two things. Number one is the students, and we have a legal obligation to take care of students. And then the second part is education. It's a fact that in the history of the Supreme Court, they did say that there are certain exceptions for the good of the public. And one of those exceptions, of course, is that I can't bring a weapon into this building. Nor can I carry a weapon into a K-12 school. Now, a K-12 school is an interesting case because, much like this computer sitting on the desk here, that's kind of like a K-12 school. It's got a nice perimeter around it. People drive up in their cars up in the front. The kids go in and out of an entrance that sometimes is already monitored. But the law says you can't carry a gun in here. The law says you can accept a K-12 school if you want to. And in the state of Alaska, we do. Now, here's where it starts to get interesting. Are we protecting the property when we do this, or are we protecting the students when we do this? And my guess is we're protecting the students. The idea is that we're going to protect the students. So the problem of protecting a school like this is one of they've decided drawing a perimeter around the school, and everything that goes on inside is protected. Now, it's interesting. I heard on the radio a couple of days ago that one of the houses in the other body has suggested a bill that would prevent use of cell phones when approaching and leaving the school to pick up your kids. So I thought, now why in the world would they do that? Well, it's to protect the kids. That's the whole reason. So we really in Alaska are concerned about protecting K-12 kids. There's no question about that. We probably have on the order of 15 to 20,000 K-12 kids who transit our campuses every single day all year long for a total of 15 to 20,000 in a year's time. We have summertime programs. We have 4-H, 10,000 in 4-H. We have Rawhi and NSEP and all these summer bridging programs. And then if you go to our rural campuses, when school's over in some of the places that I've been, you know, the library there is co-located with the community. It's a consortium library. And the kids, a lot of them, will come directly from the school over into the library. They get on the computers. They have access to books and tapes and all kinds of things. And it's part of the community campus, community integration. So one of our problems is we've got kids all year long running, the same kids that we're protecting and exempting in one case, coming all through our system. So I'm going to make the assumption that with this legislation that somehow we're going to be responsible for making sure those kids are protected. That begins to be a real problem, because now I need to look at the language in the bill and take a look at exactly what it says. May not abridged, Second Amendment may not be abridged by the Board of Regents. No arguments there. We certainly wouldn't have an argument. Except as provided by statute on line 12. I've had opinions on lawyers on both sides of this issue that there may be a constitutional issue here. I can't go there because I'm not qualified to go there. But I think I would put a yellow flag up and say, okay, this needs to be checked out. If we're going to go forward, clearly this needs to be checked out, and we need to get a reading on that. On the other side, I've got a two-sided piece of paper, and line one on the other side says the Board of Regents may adopt and enforce policies. Well, right now, we do allow guns on campus. You can carry a gun in your car. You have to leave it in your car when you go to class, but you can lock it up in your car when you park your car in any of the parking lots. You can bring it on and off the campus. But if we see somebody with a gun on the campus right now, what we can do, first of all, that's a very singular event. If you see something like that, you go up to that person and you tell them, look, guns are not allowed on campus. You're going to have to take your gun and go lock it up or leave. And then if that person refuses, the campus police can come over and remove the individuals. Under the law, as soon as the law is passed, we no longer have the ability to do that because we're not an enforcement agency. And because of the legal right of the individual to carry, even though we may suspect that individual has something else in mind, or maybe we know that they're very distraught, that they're mentally anguished, that they're drunk, that they've been in a fight, any number of things, until they commit a criminal act under the bill, then we could not act because we would not be legal to do so because they have permission to carry. And until they commit a crime, there's nothing the university could do. So that's a bit of a problem, I would say. On line 8 on the other side, it says, the Alaska Constitution, Article 1, Section 19, says, the Constitution of the State of Alaska gives the right of the individual and guarantees them the right to bear arms in defense of self and others. I can find nowhere where the word others is used in the Constitution, and I've had a couple of lawyers look. Now, why is that important? Because it suggests that it's not just me defending myself anymore. It's now giving me the option of deciding when it's okay for me to pull out my weapon and go help somebody else. And that is a horse of a different color. The stand your ground law, when coupled with self-defense, is one type of scenario. But the stand your ground law and deciding to go help others, I think, is a departure between the two and puts the others category in this language in a completely different area. And again, I don't want to go into scenarios, but I think that in terms of the language in the law, we need to make sure the language is correct and comports with the state of Alaska.
Pat, we're going to run out of time here in about a minute. Now, let me just ask the members of the committee, can I give him 5 minutes over to let him continue on? I sure would hate to miss the opportunity to have him in front of us. So if 5 minutes, can we help? Okay. We'll go till 3:05 if that's okay with everybody, which it is. Thank you.
The last point in the law itself, as I said, it says it talks about firearms. It doesn't talk about concealed carry. It doesn't discriminate. It just says firearms, automatic shotguns, Bushmasters. You can sling them over your back and go to class. You can sling it over your back, and if you're old enough, you can go to Rawhi. I speak at Rawhi every summer. I think there'd be quite a chilling effect in the classroom if I had 3 or 4 of those young juniors in high school sitting there with AR slung over their shoulder. I mean, at least in the world I came from, that would put a chilling effect on whatever academic advantage was being taken of those students at the time. And I think you can understand that. And then it says in the law, it does not include common areas of ingress and egress open to the public. So main entrances into buildings or student activity areas or crossing the campus. Here's the K-12 kids again. They are all over our campus in the summertime. They go through one building to another building. They go to the pub. They go to the student center. They go all over the place. So this gets into my final point, and that is, let's assume that you ask me what's the difficulty then of just saying, okay, we'll protect those kids. Well, that's a huge undertaking for 16 campuses to be able to protect those K-12 kids. And what I would do if I was given that task, I simply would not be able to do a fiscal note. What I would do is I would go out and hire a company that is in the business of doing exactly that, that has worked in the Middle East for probably 20 years, that would come in and look at our situation and say, okay, if you want protection, here's what you need to do across your campus to give the best protection possible. And then we would cost that up. I was in Washington last week, and I noticed one normal government office building. I walked in, and they had a place where you go through and, you know, put your radio through. They had seven people employed at one entrance. And you've got the shift work and so on and so forth. So we're talking about, I think, a huge fiscal note to cover the campus. But more important than that, if I were to say I've got a fiscal note for how to protect the campus, I would have, in effect, be telling you I can protect the campus. And I will sit here and tell you right now I cannot protect the campus if the K through 12 kids are on there. So I've got a choice. Kick the K through 12 kids off our campuses. That really makes it simple. Now we just have to worry about the professors and the staff and the kids who are not K through 12. And that's a bit of a horse of a different color. Then we can get into scenarios all you want to and with that group. But I'm looking at state law, Alaska law. K through 12 is exempted. We protect them in the schools. Do we protect them when they're on the campus? I think the answer is yes. And so that's the dilemma that we have. There's, you know, we can take off and go down several rabbit trails here, but I know time is short, and I think the best thing at this particular time, Mr. Chair, is to go ahead and stop.
Yeah, thank you. And as you can see, and I wanted to make sure that I get his perspective. We got a practical problem. We have maybe some legal authority questions, certainly constitutional questions, and then the blending of K-12 with our university system. No doubt big questions. And so we have yet several people to testify. I would only ask that you give us somebody that can speak on the legal aspects of it. If you could, you've laid out pretty good practical problem that you have. And so I'm not too sure exactly when I'm going to bring this up. I will be in touch with you and your office and with your alleged liaison to do that. And to the youngster who brought the question before us, I think anytime you bring a constitutional question to the table is very important. Being a division of the state in some way, as asserted by the young man bringing this bill, is something that I think we need to talk about. And I'm not interested in wasting our time, but I don't think this is a waste of time to talk about the campus, its public safety, and the rights of individuals. So thank you very much, President, for coming before the committee. I think you laid out some of the questions that we have to consider very thoroughly and very deeply. So I greatly appreciate it. Thanks for the members staying with us on committee overtime. Sorry to Mr. Judy from NRA. We will get to you, and I will reschedule that time. My committee obviously is dealing with issues that are in depth, and we just ran our time. We, like I say, a Judiciary Committee really should be a four-hour committee.
Yeah.
With that, we'll be adjourned.
Pat?